The Long Island Compromise captivates readers with its exploration of how wealth intersects with trauma across generations. Taffy Broadusser Akner's novel has been hailed as the great American Jewish novel by the New York Times, with celebrities like Reese Witherspoon and Oprah praising its unflinching examination of family dynamics. The book's cultural impact stems from its ability to dissect the American dream through the lens of a wealthy Jewish family whose outward success masks deep psychological wounds. What happens when the pursuit of safety and prosperity becomes its own prison? This question resonates particularly in our current era of wealth inequality and generational trauma discourse, making the novel both timely and timeless as it examines how money shapes identity but cannot protect against life's most devastating blows. On March 12, 1980, Carl Fletcher, one of the wealthiest men in Middle Rock, Long Island, was kidnapped from his driveway by two hooded men and forced into his own Cadillac. His pregnant wife, Ruth, only discovered his disappearance when she called his factory that afternoon. The FBI quickly established a command center in their waterfront Tudor home, where Ruth and her mother-in-law, Phyllis, waited anxiously for news. The two women, though not blood relatives, shared striking similarities. Both had undergone nose jobs by the same Manhattan surgeon, both maintained the same hint of mahogany hair color, both had brown eyes. As agents asked increasingly uncomfortable questions about potential enemies or affairs, the investigation began focusing on what made the Fletchers kidnappably rich. After days of agonizing silence, the phone finally rang at 6:48 a.m. A robotically filtered voice claiming to represent the Caliphate Freedom Fighters of the Valley of Palestine demanded $250,000 ransom, claiming Carl was half dead with missing fingers and ears. Following FBI instructions, Ruth made the ransom drop at JFK Airport with her young son Bernard in tow, whose tantrum had made it impossible to leave him behind. After a confusing sequence involving a misspelled note redirecting her to LaGuardia, Ruth returned home to miraculous news. Carl had been found alive at a mobile station, physically intact despite the kidnapper's claims. The FBI later discovered all the terrorist claims were fabricated. No such organization existed, nor had any of the claimed attacks occurred. The investigation eventually led to the arrest of Drexel Abraham, an ex-convict who had worked at Carl's factory, and later his brother Lionel. Both received 25-year sentences, though Drexel died in a prison riot and Lionel from pancreatic cancer. The most shocking revelation was that Carl had been held captive in his own factory's basement storage area. Though Carl physically recovered, the psychological damage proved permanent. The hood placed over his head during those 5 days created a lasting disorientation, leaving him unable to access memories from before the trauma. His memories, his feelings, his reminiscences, they existed only in those 5 days. Everything before that was precursor. Everything after that was aftermath. Despite outward appearances of recovery, Carl remained haunted. Hiring a private Mossad investigator to track the remaining ransom money, convinced he was somehow still in danger. Nathan Fletcher, Carl's middle son, grew up with the heavy burden of family expectations. As an adult, he finds himself in a precarious position when the giant supermarket project he's been overseeing hits a roadblock. When town official Lewis Squibb denies the final certificate of occupancy based on a minor bylaw violation, Nathan faces a moral crisis. During a tense lunch at the aptly named Hard Life Buffet, Lewis makes it clear he expects a bribe. For the first time in his life, Nathan decides to take a risk. With pharmaceutical calm from a beta blocker, he proposes setting up a fake charity where he could deposit money that Lewis could use for homeless people however you decide. As he leaves the restaurant in the rain, Nathan feels triumphant, flooded with the unfamiliar hormones of bravery. His victory is short-lived. Within a day, he's placed on unpaid administrative leave after being played a recording of himself attempting to bribe Lewis. Nathan's financial troubles multiply when he discovers his childhood friend Mickey, to whom he entrusted millions, has been running an elaborate Ponzi scheme. Mickey, now hospitalized from the physical toll of his extreme lifestyle, never established a legitimate investment fund with Nathan's money, instead using it to fund his lavish lifestyle. When private investigator Gal Plotkin delivers the devastating news, "Your money is gone," Nathan must confront the collapse of his financial security. Meanwhile, the family's styrofoam factory, Nathan's expected inheritance, proves unsellable. Nessman, a specialist in problematic sales, delivers the grim assessment after touring the facility with its outdated equipment, environmental violations, and chemical runoff. What was once meant to be Nathan's legacy is now a liability, requiring millions in compliance fixes. Nathan's home life crumbles simultaneously, as renovations reveal asbestos, forcing his family to relocate to his grandmother's empty house. The weight of his financial deception grows unbearable as he considers confessing everything to his wife, Alyssa, who remains distracted with their son's upcoming bar mitzvah preparations. At night, his grandmother haunts his dreams, her presence a persistent reminder of his failures and the family legacy he's losing. Bernard Beamer Fletcher, the youngest son, appears to have escaped the family's psychological baggage through his successful Hollywood screenwriting career. Yet beneath his achievements lurks profound dysfunction. As the story unfolds, Beamer spirals into creative obsession and pharmaceutical enhancement, becoming increasingly disconnected from reality. After paying a psychic $10,000 to clear his third eye, he fixates on writing a kidnapping story that he believes will be his masterpiece. While ignoring urgent messages from his wife Noelle about their daughter's school performance and desperate calls from his agent, Beamer experiences a manic creative episode where he envisions a deeply personal screenplay about a kidnapped boy whose father turns out to be the kidnapper, a role he imagines for Mandy Patinkin. His erratic behavior culminates in showing up unannounced at his agency to pitch the undeveloped concept to Patinkin's agent. When his own agent Jeremy calls to fire him, Beamer remains undeterred. Fueled by modafinil, nicotine patches, and an experimental binge of fast food despite his suppressed appetite, Beamer obtains Patinkin's address and drives to his home in a disoriented state. Upon arrival, he watches helplessly as his car rolls backward down the driveway before collapsing in front of a bewildered Patinkin. Before this breakdown, Beamer had been attempting to reform his life. He methodically cut ties with his past vices, paying his dominatrix a generous severance, deleting his drug dealer's contacts, and ending his weekly BDSM sessions. These sessions had satisfied his need for pain without the subculture trappings, evolving from simple whippings to elaborate role plays. During their final session, he experienced pain differently, observing it, examining it, saying goodbye. His reformation included establishing a healthy routine: early mornings at the office, focused writing, family dinners. He embraced fatherhood with his daughter Liesl, encouraging her flute practice with genuine love and wisdom. "If you work hard on something, the road will rise up to meet you." But when asked about happiness by his therapist, Dr. Lorna, he dismissed the concept entirely. "If it doesn't exist, it can't be on the agenda," a philosophy that ultimately contributed to his downfall. Jennifer Jenny Fletcher, born after her father's kidnapping, represents both the family's resilience and its deepest contradictions. Born with limitless potential and a voracious mind, Jenny ultimately rebels against everything her family represents, particularly their wealth. On her high school graduation night, Jenny refused to attend her own celebration, declaring it bullshit to celebrate something literally everyone could accomplish. Despite her mother Ruth's protests, Jenny insisted on leaving immediately for a summer internship at Prague's National Gallery of Art. "I'm not an animal. This is not a zoo," she declared, rejecting her mother's attempts to make her perform for family. As an adult, Jenny avoids her old friends from Middle Rock, finding their conventional lives with marriages and vacations to be a mockery of bourgeois boredom. Instead, she spends her evenings lecturing her family about workers' rights, declaring, "This is America. Workers' rights are an American value," much to her grandmother Phyllis's dismay. Jenny's radicalization is cemented by news of Glenn Finkelstein's death. Her father's childhood friend who had struggled financially while raising a cello prodigy daughter. Desperate to fund his daughter's talent, Glenn had engaged in cemetery plot fraud, selling the same plot repeatedly to young, healthy people. After his scheme collapsed, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison and died in a prison transfer accident. Jenny's relationship with her academic boyfriend Andrew ends when he visits her family's estate and discovers her wealth. After calling her epithets during sex and accusing her of hiding her privilege, Jenny ends things. Andrew's criticism prompts her to start giving away her money to unions and anti-Yale encroachment initiatives, trying to feel what it's like to have no money. But she realizes giving away wealth isn't the same as never having it. Years later, during a confrontation with her brother Beamer, he suggests she's chosen her career as a union organizer merely to rebel against their family rather than from genuine passion. "You're a low-level bureaucrat," he tells her, pointing out she's aging while surrounded by college students. Deeply hurt by the realization that Beamer's is one of them rather than her ally, Jenny's worldview begins to crumble. The Fletcher family saga begins with Zelig Fletcher, an immigrant who arrived in America after World War II. Using his mathematical aptitude and chemical knowledge, he approached a rubber factory owner with a proposal to create polystyrene molds for safely shipping delicate objects. The innovation proved successful, and eventually Zelig purchased the factory, renaming it Consolidated Packing Solutions LTD. As his business prospered, Zelig promoted his friend Laser to foreman. During a Thanksgiving visit to Laser and his wife Manya in Little Neck, Zelig got lost and discovered Middle Rock's tranquil beauty along Shore Turnpike. Looking out at the sound, he realized he could be happy in America. When he found a storm-damaged 16-acre estate for sale on Ocean Vista Road, he purchased it with his cash savings and began renovations. Zelig met Frida Muchnick, who introduced herself as Phyllis, at a singles dance at Young Israel of Flatbush. She was tall, outspoken, and college-educated, reluctantly attending at her mother's insistence. Their meeting began when she witnessed him struggling to parallel park his Buick Roadmaster. After helping him park, they went for ice cream, and Zelig knew he'd found what he came for. They married at Temple Beth Israel, just a mile from his estate. Phyllis gave birth to a daughter and then a son named Carl, Hebrew name Chaim, after the young man who had saved Zelig's life. Under Zelig's influence, Middle Rock flourished as a haven from the horrors of Jewish history, becoming the first American suburb with a half-Jewish population. These immigrants assimilated by adopting WASP aesthetics, boat shoes, Bermuda shorts, popped collars, and blonde hair, founding pool and boat clubs to complete their transformation into indistinguishable Americans, safe from persecution, their very own Canaan. Years after Zelig's death, the family business faces another devastating crisis when Consolidated Packing Solutions burns down in a conflagration that lights up the night sky over Milwaukee's industrial district. On the night of the fire, Carl's sister Marjorie is discovered by first responders sitting motionless on the loading dock, her expensive wool coat covered in soot, clutching a box of wooden matches. Despite Carl's frantic protests and attempts to explain her fragile mental state, police officers escort a visibly distraught Marjorie away from the smoldering ruins. At the police station, the true complexity of Marjorie's condition emerges. Her psychiatrist reveals that she had been prescribed a dangerous cocktail of medications: Benicar for blood pressure, Trazodone for depression, Klonopin for anxiety, and Ativan for panic attacks. This combination triggered severe hallucinations in which Marjorie believed she was receiving instructions from a Dybbuk, a malicious possessing spirit from Jewish folklore, that had taken the form of Ruth, her sister-in-law. In her altered state, Marjorie became convinced that Ruth was actually her mother's spirit returned to seek vengeance on the family business. The Dybbuk becomes a powerful, recurring motif throughout the novel, symbolizing how unresolved trauma haunts and possesses successive generations of the family. Just as a Dybbuk inhabits an unwilling host, the psychological wounds of previous generations manifest in increasingly destructive ways among the younger family members. Marjorie's breakdown represents the culmination of decades of suppressed grief, family tensions, and unaddressed mental health issues. The factory fire marks more than just a financial catastrophe. It symbolizes the culmination of the family's gradual decline. What was once the crown jewel of their business empire, employing hundreds and serving as a testament to immigrant success, becomes a charred monument to their unraveling. The destruction of Consolidated Packing Solutions mirrors the family's increasingly precarious position in society. Behind their carefully maintained facade of wealth and status lies mounting debt, fractured relationships, and psychological instability. The smoke from the fire, literally and figuratively, tarnishes their reputation in the community, forcing them to confront the possibility that their golden age has passed. As Rabbi Weintraub explains to Nathan during their pivotal conversation, a plastic hour represents those extraordinary moments in life when everything becomes malleable despite, or perhaps because of, profound suffering. These are times when genuine transformation becomes possible, when the rigid structures of identity and habit soften enough to allow for fundamental change. The rabbi suggests that every family has its own biblical mythology, its own book worthy of being written, complete with trials, revelations, and moments of profound transformation. For the Fletchers, multiple plastic hours arrive throughout the narrative, each presenting a distinct opportunity for metamorphosis. Carl's kidnapping shatters the family's illusion of invulnerability and forces them to confront their interconnectedness. The factory fire strips away the physical manifestation of their wealth and legacy, compelling them to question what truly matters. Nathan's attempted bribery represents a moral crisis that challenges his understanding of integrity and privilege. Beamer's breakdown reveals the cost of maintaining facades and suppressing trauma, while Jenny's confrontation with her privilege marks a turning point in her understanding of her place in the world and her responsibilities to others. These moments of crisis serve as potential catalysts for change, though the family members respond differently to each opportunity. Some retreat further into familiar patterns, while others gradually open themselves to transformation. The plastic hour concept illustrates how trauma, while devastating, can create spaces for profound personal growth and healing. The rabbi's wisdom about plastic hours serves as a powerful counterpoint to the Fletcher family's characteristic rigidity, their deep-seated belief in wealth as the cornerstone of identity, their generational pattern of suppressing and avoiding trauma, and their collective reluctance to confront uncomfortable truths about themselves and their history. These moments of malleability suggest that even in their most difficult circumstances, perhaps especially then, the possibility for genuine change exists if they can recognize and embrace it. The plastic hour metaphor extends beyond individual transformation to encompass the family's collective evolution. It suggests that families, like individuals, have moments when their established patterns and dynamics become fluid enough to be reshaped. These opportunities often arise during crises that force them to question their fundamental assumptions about themselves and their relationships with one another. As the novel progresses, long-buried family secrets begin to surface. During a confrontation at a burrito place, Ike Besser's son Max reveals to Jenny that he'd researched her father's kidnapping case for a pre-law class. He claims the Abraham brothers were slow-witted and couldn't have masterminded the crime alone, suggesting someone else was involved and that Jenny's grandmother had pressured the DA to zip it when suspicions arose. According to Max, Drexel Abraham wrote letters from prison trying to reveal who had planned the kidnapping, but died before the truth came out. This revelation forces Jenny to question everything she thought she knew about her family's defining trauma. Jenny also recalls a traumatic childhood memory from Nathan's bar mitzvah day. Left alone at home at age 5, she heard strange moaning that turned into screaming. Following the sound upstairs, she discovered her father naked on the bathroom floor, kneeling before exposed pipes under the sink, emitting horrifying screams from deep within his body, an incomprehensible scene she fled from and would struggle to understand for years. These revelations suggest that the family's wealth may be built on more complicated foundations than Jenny had previously understood. The possibility that her grandmother might have covered up aspects of the kidnapping investigation adds another layer to the family's complex relationship with money, power, and truth. After confronting uncomfortable truths about her family and herself, Jenny experiences what she calls semantic evacuation, a profound psychological state where familiar concepts, relationships, and daily activities suddenly lose their meaning and coherence. This crisis manifests first in her professional life, as she abruptly abandons her position at the union where she once felt purposeful. The ideals that had driven her work, social justice, collective action, workers' rights, now seem hollow and disconnected from reality. Her retreat into isolation becomes both a symptom and a coping mechanism. Jenny attempts to find meaning through artistic expression, setting up an elaborate home studio with expensive materials, but finds herself unable to create anything meaningful. The blank canvases mock her inability to translate her internal turmoil into tangible form. Even simple tasks like grocery shopping or answering phone calls become overwhelming as the framework of normal life dissolves around her. The video game mogul becomes her primary escape, offering a simplified simulation of the life she can no longer navigate in reality. The game's mechanics are deliberately mundane. Players earn points for maintaining regular sleep schedules, attending fictional meetings, and managing virtual relationships. Its libertarian philosophy, suggesting that success is purely a matter of individual choice and discipline, contradicts Jenny's former leftist beliefs, yet she finds herself addicted to its ordered world. The game provides what reality cannot: clear rules, predictable outcomes, and the illusion of control. When Jenny discovers her trust fund has evaporated, her reaction reveals how deeply semantic evacuation has altered her perspective. Instead of panic, she experiences an almost transcendent sense of relief. The money that once served as both safety net and burden, defining her identity while simultaneously preventing authentic self-discovery, is gone. This loss creates what Jenny recognizes as a plastic hour, a rare moment of malleability where fundamental change becomes possible. The phenomenon of semantic evacuation ripples throughout the Fletcher family, manifesting differently in each member but sharing common threads of disconnection and loss. Carl's trauma from his time as a war correspondent has left him unable to find meaning in civilian life or connect with his children. Nathan's financial collapse forces him to question his identity as a provider and business success story. Beamer's obsessive focus on his documentary project becomes a shield against meaningful human connection. Jenny's ideological disillusionment mirrors broader questions about privilege, purpose, and authenticity. Their collective experience suggests that wealth, while providing material security, often creates its own form of existential poverty. The Fletcher struggle demonstrates how financial privilege can actually impede the development of genuine meaning and authentic relationships, leaving its beneficiaries trapped in gilded but empty lives. The novel's title, The Long Island Compromise, refers to the multi-layered bargain struck by the Fletcher family and others like them, trading authentic identity for safety and prosperity in American society. Zelig Fletcher's generation compromised by methodically assimilating, adopting WASP aesthetics and behaviors to escape persecution. This meant changing everything from their manner of dress and speech patterns to their social circles and religious observances. Carl's generation compromised by prioritizing financial security over emotional health, working punishing hours and suppressing trauma to build generational wealth. Nathan's generation compromised by maintaining appearances at all costs, perfect homes, prestigious schools, country club memberships, while sacrificing personal integrity and genuine connections. Jenny's generation compromises through performative rebellion against wealth while still benefiting from its privileges, living in expensive neighborhoods while claiming to reject materialism. Each compromise exacts its own distinct price. Zelig achieves the American dream, successful business, suburban home, respected status, but remains haunted by memories of the family he left behind in Europe and the cultural heritage he abandoned. Carl builds a thriving manufacturing empire, but loses his sense of self after the kidnapping, becoming a hollow shell of his former self. Nathan maintains an impeccable suburban life, complete with tennis lessons, private schools, and summer homes, until it spectacularly collapses under financial pressure, revealing the fragility beneath the facade. Beamer achieves Hollywood success, but spirals into self-destruction through drugs, failed relationships, and an inability to maintain genuine connections. Jenny rejects her family's materialistic values, but struggles to establish a meaningful alternative, finding herself trapped between authenticity and privilege. The novel suggests that such compromises are inevitable in the American immigrant experience, but come with profound consequences. The pursuit of safety through wealth and assimilation creates its own peculiar vulnerabilities. Psychological damage from suppressing identity, ethical compromises made in the name of success, and spiritual emptiness that money cannot fill. The Fletcher family's journey across four generations reveals how money fundamentally shapes identity but cannot protect against life's most devastating blows: death, betrayal, loss of love, and the dissolution of family bonds. Their story serves as a nuanced microcosm of the American Jewish experience, and more broadly, the American dream itself, with all its glittering promises, inherent contradictions, and hidden costs that echo through generations. The Long Island setting itself becomes symbolic, a place of both refuge and exile, where success and sacrifice are inextricably intertwined.